Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz here with you, coming to you live from the Kintech studio. Get your texts in, 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line. It's time for us to go to the Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning hotline. The first call, the only call, where we welcome in the triple threat, Ian McIntyre. And this insider is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Thanks for taking the time, Ian. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I have to say I was curious whether Thomas Drantz would actually get his hands on the steering wheel and drive the show, or whether he would just ride shotgun again, leave it to the young radio professional like yourself, and be along
for
the ride. Now I know.
Now you know. Yeah.
I go solo sometimes, Mac. Sometimes I do the whole thing myself, and I screw up all the ad reads. So whenever they have someone else to pay the bills, they prefer it.
Actually, I don't blame you at all. If I was there, I'd be in the third row. I'd be at the back somewhere, just yelling things up to the front as it suited me. But
that's how it goes. Well, that's why I'm here. I'm just here to read ads. But Ian, I appreciate you taking the time. Big news from Morning Skate this morning. So Archdeep Baines made his debut the other day. Very impressive, played well, and now seems to be getting a shot in the top six. What does that say about Rick Tocchet's first impressions of Baines in the NHL?
Well, I think it says a couple of things about Rick Tocchet. It says, first of all, that he did like what he saw with Archdeep. And we know Tocchet values hockey IQ, as most coaches do, probably more than most fans do or most fans understand. And Baines is a really smart player. He brought that skill with him when the Canucks signed him, that he's always had hockey IQ, but they've taught him how to play. They've taught him, I mean, he knew how to score. They've taught him how to play now. And in fact, last year with Abbotsford, Colinton had him on the PK before he had him on the power play. So they've sort of built Baines' game from his own goal out. And Tocchet liked what he saw. But I think the other thing it says with this promotion for game two of Baines' career is that the team's lost three in a row. And the coach is looking for ways to freshen the lineup, to spark things, to try new things so that they don't lose four in a row. And I think it's a really interesting move. I don't think that Baines at all will be in over his head. If you keep in mind, he's replacing Pugh Suter, who's kind of like the template for the understated, nuanced, smart hockey player. So Baines doesn't have to go out there and score, although that would be nice if it happened. He just has to play a smart, complementary game. And we know that he has the skill level to hang with top players. So we'll see how it goes tonight.
The other kind of encouraging part about this is we've heard kind of the organization preaching the same kind of structure in the AHL and the NHL. And when a guy like this comes in to Vancouver and kind of immediately, look, it's one game and we'll have to see how it progresses, but seems to have an immediate fit. What does that say about how well that organizational structure is working so far?
Well, I think it reinforces what we've been saying about the organization all season, which they finally, and really, if you go back to when they fired Bruce Boudreau and brought in Rick Tocchet, they finally have alignment from top to bottom. And I think we've seen benefits in other players, of course, that guys like Nils Åman and Nils Höglander, how much they benefited from their time in the AHL last year, and they brought that back to the Canucks this season. I got to say, I was a little surprised. It was about a month ago or so, I talked to Patrick Aldean in Pittsburgh, and I raised the subject of the number of UFAs they have on this team, and clearly, you know, they're not going to be able to bring them all back. I would hope they bring back at least a couple especially Dakota Joshua. But Alvin volunteered about the number of players they have in Abbotsford who he feels are ready or will be ready next season to take another step. And Baines was one of the guys he mentioned, but he also mentioned Max Sassam. He mentioned Cole McWard, Linus Carlson, Vasily Podkolzin. Like, they have a lot of guys that they feel have learned to play the right way in the AHL, and now it's time to try them. And I'm not surprised that the Baines would show well to this point, but it's an awfully small sample, and there's lots of guys who come in, and whether it's, you know, adrenaline or whatever, the inspiration, the moment, you know, they do well at the start, and then it's hard for them to sustain it. It wouldn't surprise me if he sustained it, but it also wouldn't surprise me if there's more guys like him who are ready to come up and help this team, at least in a complementary role.
Ian, how much of what Tocchet is looking for, do you think, is also predicated on, you know, putting Suter, who's been one of their most reliable forwards all season, into the, you know, old Joshua spot to try and get that third line, which has powered this club so frequently 5-on-5, going again?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I hope you can hear me.
Is everything okay?
Wow.
Ian?
Ian, what have you done?
Yeah,
no, I'm okay. I'm walking from Climate Pledge back to my hotel. I'm in the shadow of the monorail.
Yeah.
And there is actually a shadow because it's a beautiful day, but it's a busy downtown, as you guys know. I think it's a balancing of lines, Thomas. Like it would be kind of foolish to say that each guy's getting a promotion, right? When they just swap positions, that Suter goes from the Miller line to the Bluger line, and Baines goes the other way. But I think it's a balancing. And, you know, that line hasn't been the same without Dakota Joshua, but I don't think that's really on Baines, and it won't be on Suter tonight. They don't have a lot of players like Dakota Joshua. They don't exist in abundance. Guys who are that big and naturally aggressive physically, yet have enough skill to play with good players and are smart. You know, Dakota Joshua is killing penalties because he is smart. IQ is one of the biggest factors for guys who do that job. So I think it'll probably help Bluger and Garland that they have a guy who's got as much experience and well-roundedness as Pugh Suter, but I still think they're going to continue to miss Dakota Joshua as long as he's out of the lineup.
I'm sensing from our inbox, from my Twitter mentions, the comments on my articles, which I shouldn't read, that there's a lot of frustration in this market about Elias Pettersson's performance of late. What are you seeing, and what do you think the basis of that frustration is?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot that goes into that, Thomas, and I think we'd be awfully naive and kind of ignoring basic human instinct to think that some of the reaction isn't based on his contract situation, that some people are unhappy with the stance that Elias Pettersson has taken in not negotiating with the club. And whenever he has a quiet game or a couple of quiet games, that displeasure is voiced. I think that's part of it for sure. But I also think that the top players on this team have not been as consistently elite the last month or so as they were at the start of the season. And Rick Tocchet himself referenced that. I'm trying to think after which game. It might have been the 4-0 loss in Boston, where he talked about McAvoy and Marchand showing up, and, you know, where were the Canucks top players? And he said something Talkett did, like, they haven't been good in, and he was going to say a while or weeks or something. He didn't finish the thought. I think both Miller and Pettersson have been very good in some games, and they've been not as good as they would like to be in others. I'm not saying that they've been poor, because they are elite players. You know, it's not a fluke that they're where they are in an NHL scoring, but I think they've lost some consistency. Now, the good part about that, I think Miller, since they came off that last road trip, a couple of games at home, and now this road trip, which hasn't gone well for the Canucks so far, I think Miller is playing pretty well. I think he's moving his feet again, and he looks like JT Miller again. And now it's just a matter of Pettersson. And again, it's not that Pettersson has been poor. I think, again, to reiterate, some of the criticism is due to other factors other than how he's playing. But for sure, he can build a little more consistency or rediscover, I guess, that consistency. Because we know he has it in him, that he can be. I mean, he was great all last season. He's been great for most of this season. And by great, I mean world class. I mean, one of the best players who play this game. I think he can rediscover some of that consistency. And, you know, ultimately, the Canucks, if they're going to win, remember, if you go back to the start of the year and Jim Rutherford saying everything has to go right. So far, everything's gone right, other than, you know, right now they've lost three in a row. But what they really need, if they're going to do anything, is to have all their top guys on top of their game. And I think there's a little room to grow there for Pettersson and others.
And when this Pettersson conversation comes up, Ian, it's the games people point to are the ones against some of the top teams in the West and in the NHL, like Colorado, Boston, Vegas. And to be fair, the Canucks really haven't had a crazy amount of opportunities against the teams that people are pointing to. How big are these games kind of down the stretch in terms of people regaining trust in Pettersson, whether it's these Winnipeg games or Vegas games or Boston on the weekend, for example?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they're important for everyone. But to my point that some of the criticism is based on things other than his play, that criticism for the other things aren't going to go, you know, whether it's his contract position, whether it's his demeanor on the ice, you know, because the Sedins were criticized for that as well. I'm like, you know, how come they don't celebrate more? How come they don't look more enthusiastic? Like, that was literally a conversation in our market at times when the Sedins were among the best players in the world. I'm not sure I think it will just kind of suppress that element of the criticism if Pettersson does well against top teams. But, you know, the Canucks, it's very important. They got a lot of big games down the stretch against, you know, Colorado, Vegas, LA looks sort of reborn again. Thank goodness they played all the games against Edmonton when Edmonton was terrible. So, I mean, almost all the games. Mm-hmm. So they have some big games. And I think it's more than about Pettersson. I think it's about this team that you have to show that you can beat the best. And the Canucks at times, I think they have beaten a lot of good teams. You go back to, you know, they beat Florida. They won and they beat the Rangers in New York. They've had other games where, you know, Dallas, they've played some elite teams and won it. Of course, all the games at Edmonton when Edmonton was scuffling. But ultimately, you know, you're not going to see Chicago in the playoffs, right? You're going to, if you want to do anything, you're going to have to beat these teams in multiples. So I think that's what's important in these big games down the stretch.
It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott, Wolf, Thomas Drantz, joined now by Sportsnet's triple threat, Ian McIntyre. So one of the other changes we saw at Morning Skate today was on the power play. It's been 1-for-9 in the past few games. People have not loved how it's been going lately. And we see Philip Hronek slide into the top unit again. Elias Lindholm no longer on the top unit, at least in Morning Skate. Does that change make sense to you, or is it kind of like, for me, when I looked at it, it felt like change for the sake of change, and it does feel like the power play needs something. I just don't know if that was necessarily what I was looking for personally.
Yeah, I don't think it's a long-term move. I think it is short-term. I think it's to much like moving Baines up the lineup, it gives the team a different look. Maybe it gives them a bit of a jolt. Maybe it gives them a freshness. But I also think the other thing about Philip Roenick is he loves to shoot. And what we've seen with this power play, and it's not unique to this power play, is that when it struggles, nobody wants to have the responsibility, it seems at times, of taking a shot other than Quinn. And his are so often getting blocked because basically the penalty killers just put a guy out in front of them. I think it's Tocchet sending a message about the objective of the whole thing is to get pucks to the net. And then Rick has talked a lot this season, many times, about being aggressive. And when you beat the pressure, attacking the net in numbers. And he said this morning, you know, get 2-1s down low. And that's where the Canucks have failed, because other teams are playing them so high. And the power play near the end of the game against Colorado the other night was a great example how much of that power play, Miller seemed to be stuck on the sideboards. Quinn was at the top of the umbrella and wasn't, you know, penetrating. Brock was on the other side. And it was very static. And the only decent chance they had on that power play when the game was on the line was when Pettersson aggressively took the puck to the net. I can't remember whether it was an interchange, a pass, or he just went around somebody, but he had a chance to take it to the net, took it to the net aggressively. There was a bit of a scramble. I think Miller had a whack at it. That's what the Canucks need to do, try to do on every power play, is get the puck to the net. I think putting Roenick there, it wouldn't surprise me if he had 8 shots tonight, Philip Roenick. Putting Roenick there sends a clear message about the value of getting pucks to the net and then attacking it, following the puck to the net.
You heard it from Ian McIntyre. You go bet the shots milestones, the shots milestones ladder on Philip Roenick, 5, 6, 7, 8 per IMAC. Mac, just special teams in general, like they're -9 on the PK since the All-Star break. They've scored 3 on the power play since the All-Star break, but they've allowed 3 against, so they're net 0 there. It seems like that's really holding back some of this team's improved 5-on-5 form. Are you seeing anything that is a meaningful concern for you? Like, can this team get to where they want to go if their special teams are only good?
Yeah, I think I'm not concerned at all about the penalty kill, because I think that Minnesota debacle skews everything lower. And, you know, 3 of the 4 goals were 5-on-3s. And, you know, I don't think they'd allowed that many 5-on-3s in the season. at least goals against, I mean. So you throw out that. I think the penalty killing has been fine, and it's been good over a long period. But that's why I am actually a little bit concerned about the power play, because it has been below average for a long period of time. And ultimately, with the players they have and the needs they have, and again, everything gets amplified at playoff time. When you're in a series and you have to win again, like everything is so important. They need their power play to be going better than it has. And I think this is something that, you know, there's not. When the team's in first place and we thought it was just going to be in the mosh pit for the wild card race, there's not a whole lot to criticize. But I think it's one thing that Tocchet has to wear, because he's the guy who primarily has been running this first unit, that it has underperformed for a while. Now, in totality, you add the PK and the power play, they've been above 100. So it hasn't really hurt them, and they've been a pretty good 5-on-5 team for a while now. So I don't think it's undermining them to a huge degree, but it will. It will unless the power play gets better.
Do you think Edmonton can make Game 80 matter in terms of winning the Pacific Division?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've been unstoppable. They got games in hand on everybody. I think it's going to be, as the British would say, this is going to be a grandstand finish in the Pacific division. You know, the Vegas is Vegas, right? And they've won a cup, and they look like one of those teams that can just kind of flex if they have to,
right.
if they're healthy, right? And we've seen other teams like that. And LA is such an enigma. They were so good at the start and bad enough that they got the coach fired. And it looks like maybe they're going to get the coaching bounce that Edmonton has had. So, you know, this race is a long way from over, and absolutely, absolutely game 80 could mean something.
Hey, Ian, really appreciate you taking the time, and enjoy game 80 or 59 tonight.
Yeah, we're going to be at 80 pretty soon. Already at 59. Time flies when you're having fun.
Oh, for sure. Thanks, Ian. Have a good one.
See you guys.
There is Ian McIntyre. By the way, Ian McIntyre brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. And yeah, it would be, in terms of drawing interest for the rest of the season, it would be kind of fun if game 80 mattered. As a Canucks fan, though, you're probably looking at it and being like, well, it'd be nice if it was salted away by then, the Pacific Division. But Edmonton is looking, they're looking real dangerous right now.
To eke out a point last night when they fell behind 4-1 against the Bruins, that was a wild performance. Like, there were moments where the Oilers turned up where they looked genuinely terrifying. Like, clearly the best team in hockey, which is what I expected them to be in the regular season going into the year. It didn't start that way, but it does feel like they're rounding into form. The main thing here is if the Canucks can just take care of business, like as well as the Oilers have played, it's going to require something historic for them to get to like 110 points. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Canucks can get to 110 points by just managing like 103 point pace between now and the end of the year. Like, the Canucks just have to take care of business, and they're going to make it prohibitively difficult for the Oilers to catch them, which is why, you know, 9 games of 500 hockey, Oilers still need a lot to go their way to catch the Canucks. But if the Canucks play another 9 games of 500 hockey here, the door's going to be wide open.
Yeah, Canucks, that starts tonight, looking to keep pulling away from the Oilers against the Kraken in Seattle. We'll get into the Seattle side of things. On the other side, Allison Lucan going to join us here on Canucks Talk. It is Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz here with you. In a moment, going to be joined by Allison Lucan. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. And we are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of 5-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? And also Jampro, the leaders in commercial cleaning and janitorial. If your workplace demands a clean environment, contact Jampro for a free, no-obligation quote. Visit jampro.ca. And now we go to the Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Hotline. Allison Lucan joining us on Canucks Talk, covers Kraken for Root Sports, and one-third of the Too Many Men podcast. Thanks for taking the time, Allison. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
I appreciate you taking the time. And so Canucks Kraken in Seattle tonight. I was talking about it earlier in the show. We keep waiting for this rivalry to happen, to pick up. And it kind of feels like tonight could theoretically be a big step. You know, the Canucks looking to snap a 3-game losing streak, and the Kraken fighting to get into the playoffs as well.
Yeah, you know, and we've talked about this before. It takes a bit of back and forth to really make a rivalry, and unfortunately for Kraken fans, the back has not been happening for the Kraken. It's basically been a Vancouver-sided series through the years, but I agree. If the Kraken can find a way to muster out a win tonight, or maybe this goes to overtime or a shootout, Vancouver obviously wants to get back in the win column, and the Kraken desperately need every single standing point that they can get. So whichever way this game goes, I think it could start to really fuel those fires a little bit more.
One thing that was kind of surprising to me this morning, at least, is we would get a lot of starts in Seattle. He's been performing very, very well, but it looks like it's going to be Philip Grubauer tonight for the Kraken. Is this a break for the Canucks, or is this maybe a sneaky good move for the Seattle?
Yeah, you know, they did take an optional skate this morning, and Dave Hakstol does not like to disclose his goaltender, so I don't know that we know 100% yet who's going, but I would actually feel good about either goaltender, to your point. You know, Joey Decord has been playing really, really, really well. And Philip Grubauer, while he only has one start, and that was the win on the island over the road trip, he looks really strong. It was a very impressive game from him, especially after being off for over 2 months due to injury and then serving as the backup. And what I sensed in the room after that game is that the guys really rallied around playing in front of him too after that long layoff and the work that he had to do to come back. So hopefully for the Kraken, whichever goaltender suits up and slides into that net to start this game is a good omen for them.
Allison, the Kraken stabilized their season in December leading into that outdoor game. And then again in January for a bit. Really, it was Joey Decord who was sort of the face of that resurgence. And then lately, since the All-Star break, it maybe hasn't been good enough for a team that still has ground to make up. What's gone wrong for the Kraken relative to where they were in December and January over the course of the past few weeks?
Yeah, you know, and this has been something that's kind of plagued this team all season. It's a lack of consistency, or maybe consistency in the wrong way when that tracks, in that, you know, the first game out of a break, you're facing a Flyers team who's been playing well and has already got, I think they had three games under their belt, or it was their third game at that point post-break. So it was easy to kind of write that first game off as rust. But the second game against New Jersey, they just didn't come out strong. They didn't push back until the third period. And there's just been some times in this season where the group doesn't have the jump and doesn't have the urgency that, especially this time of year, that you need. So, you know, there have been some injuries, but that's not the case right now. The group has started to get going. They looked excellent against Boston. I thought they played really well against Detroit. They just couldn't get some bounces going their way. But this game is going to be a real test, not just in terms of the opponent, but how does the Kraken dictate how they come out, how they play, and what their effort level is going to be?
What do you expect from the Kraken between now and March 8th, and how much of what happens here? Because they have some really appealing players who are expiring, and yet we know that, you know, the run last season really galvanized this market. It's still a competitive sports market. They're still the new kid on the block here. I mean, it's a tough balance for Ron Francis to weigh. So how much will their performance ahead of March 8, do you think, dictate what comes next?
Yeah, you know, I think it's going to be interesting. I think that regardless of what happens, this isn't a team that is yet ready to get into the big buyer business. Their window is still ahead of them. But in terms of any selling, I think that, you know, these next few games are huge. It's Vancouver, obviously, tonight, and then it's Minnesota, who's also in front of them in the standings right now.
Right.
Then you've got a tough Boston team coming in that's going to want to avenge the loss on their ice. So this is one of the purest cases I think we've seen in a while of letting the team tell the GM if we're going to hold on to the players we have, or if we're going to start listening to offers and see. You know, I think Ron is savvy. I don't think he's going to undersell or take a cheap deal for any of the free agents that are here right now. But if he gets a really nice offer and this team is not showing him that they can continue to push for a spot, he's going to listen to those offers a little bit more than maybe if they win these next three or four.
If things do go sideways here, do you think the selling is limited to like pending free agents, or could it be guys maybe with a year after, like looking at Brandon Tanev or some other players like Yanni Gord as well? Or is it just guys like Eberle, Wenberg that would be on the market?
Yeah, you know, obviously Ron Francis is not sitting down and opening up his call log to me. But, you know, I think that, of course, it's going to be the UFAs first, as most teams would do. And I think that Ron would be foolish to not listen to offers on other players. But I do think it would take quite a big amount. You know, you look at, you see different players in different markets, like a Boone Jenner, where leadership just comes out and says, we're not moving him, pretty much, period. I think players like Yanni Gourde, are so central to how this team plays. Obviously, a player like Matty Beniers, you got Ryker Evans on the back end, and I'm only naming a handful there that I think would be off limits regardless of the deal.
You mentioned that the Canucks, the Kraken probably aren't big game hunting, and obviously they're not really in a position to at this deadline. But I do wonder what, like Drantz mentioned, still maybe trying to win over the market a bit, or at least increase their hold on the market. How important do you think it is, maybe not at the deadline, but in the offseason, to try to address that kind of lack of star talent that they have on their roster right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, the fans here have been tremendously loyal. And I think that what's going to go a long way first and foremost is that as this team does cement itself, the cool thing about that is that you see players who maybe aren't tier one NHL players, but are certainly excellent players, like a Yanni Gourde, that the market really latches onto, a Philip Grubauer. They love him here. And as long as this team plays competitively, I think they have bought themselves some more time. But, you know, for the Kraken, I think that maybe the next big wave is going to be next year, as you say, in the offseason, is Shane Wright on this team? This is a player that they've heard a lot about in this market. Is he ready? He's doing very well in Coachella. Now he's had an injury that's taken him out of play for the past week or so, but is Shane Wright ready on this team? Is another player, Ryan Winterton, came up and played a couple games and looked really good. Is Ryker Evans now cemented on the blue line? I think that the first wave of fresh talent before it's big fish hunting might be showing how the youth is stepping into full-time NHL roles.
Allison, we know you know everything about the Kraken, but we also know that you're a smart analyst in general, and this Pacific Division, I was fascinated by it before this season. Some things have occurred that have surprised me. Some things have occurred that haven't. The Canucks would be top line item in terms of surprising me. I think the Kraken being only okay as opposed to a little bit tougher, an out would qualify as a surprise for me as well. When you look at this division as a whole, like, how do you handicap Vancouver's perch atop the division? Do you think Edmonton has a realistic shot of catching them?
Well, we all know on this show that I have famously been hard on the Edmonton Oilers. but what they did in that win run was just shockingly impressive. I was fortunate enough to cover when Columbus went on the similar length run, and it's really something to see. It's incredible to watch. So that changed my mind quite a bit, and they've got the confidence now. They've got the rolling. The goaltending has kind of calmed down in the right way for them. I think Edmonton can start to come up and push, particularly with, you know, the news coming out of Vegas that Mark Stone is out for a little bit. That's such a huge piece of that team. For me, Vegas being as strong as they were out of the gate was a surprise as well. So does Vegas falter and the two teams battling it out up top are Vancouver and Edmonton? I think that's a very realistic outcome that we could see come games 75 through 82.
The Kings too, right? They had some struggles. I wasn't worried about them. They've bounced back a little bit since the coaching change. Is that how tough an out do you expect the Kings to be? Is that like a legitimate elite team that had a 1 month blip, or is there something more complicated going on there?
Yeah, you know, it for me, and we've all seen this, right? The new coach comes in, there's a nice little bump, and then things kind of settle back down. We can't, so
we're experts in that.
So, you know, I'm not convinced on what they are yet. I will say that, you know, they're always going to be tough because they're so sound structurally. But goaltending remains a little bit of a question there. And I didn't love the noise coming out of the room. You know, that group has always struck me. They have that Bruins-esque quality of the core really setting the tone and really setting the direction for not just how the team plays outwardly, but how they play inwardly and what drives them. And, you know, and to hear Drew Doughty calling people out and things like that, I have no doubt that things like that can get fixed, but that does give me pause four, when you're in a dogfight, like the Kings now have found themselves, where does the grit come from? Where does the push come from in addition to how they can execute? So I'm not sold on them. I think they're still definitely leaning into being in the playoffs after the season, but it's going to be a little bit of a harder go than maybe we thought 6-8 weeks ago.
And the other Pacific Division team that we haven't really touched on, Vegas, you mentioned the Mark Stone injury. That news in the past couple days looks like he's going to be out at least until the playoffs. It does give them some LTIR space to work with, which we know Vegas, they love to work with that. They just feel like the sleeping giant team in the Pacific Division. And it does feel like when they get to the playoffs, they're just going to flip a switch and turn it on.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, you look at when they had a little bit of a blip in the negative direction, and that was another instance where there were a lot of injuries going on, right? You know, they didn't look like themselves when they were here for the Winter Classic, to be honest. I thought the Kraken played a solid game, but Vegas certainly did not present the kind of challenge I expected them to. And then it was right after that that, you know, Carlson goes out and they're starting to lose players left and right. So I agree. I think this is a team we just talked about, you know, internal motivation, the unmeasured intangibles that we have right now. And I think Vegas has that switch that they can flip. And I think they're really, really hungry to show that they can do what they did last year again.
And we're talking about like Seattle leading up to the deadline here. And we talk about these teams in the Pacific, LA, Edmonton, obviously the Canucks are having a really good year. Vegas, like, all seem legitimate threats when they get to the playoffs. How much does that play into what Seattle does ahead of the deadline? Because, I mean, even if they add here, it might not be worth it based on who they would have to play to really make a run.
Oh, 100%. You know, and I agree with the logic. I don't know that that is part of the decision-making, however. If I had to guess, you know, you look at the ledger, right? And you say this is still a prospect pipeline that needs to get more and more full. We are not on the cusp. We are probably not one of the top 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 teams in the league this season, and that's okay. So why would we spend assets that we need to serve us much more importantly down the line, spend those now for a short-term return that probably isn't the ultimate prize? So I don't know if it's the standings and the division as much yet. In a few years, hopefully that is part of the equation. But I think for Seattle right now, it's still about building to that window and making sure that they protect as much assets as they can in the bank so that this organization has layers of talent for years to come.
Allison, why has it taken Riker Evans so long to earn the sort of shot that, based on what I saw in preseason, I expected him to get like within 10 games?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think that, you know, when Brian Dumoulin was signed this year, we all kind of said, so maybe Riker isn't quite ready yet. And I get that decision. I get that gamble by the front office. And I will say, you know, at the last preseason game when I watched him, I certainly saw a future NHL player, but there were still just a few little gaps in his game where I was like, oh, maybe not just yet. Now he comes back up to the team in December due to injury and looks ready. And I think he looked great. And that was when he really surprised me. And I said, okay, he is ready. But, you know, there are still some lessons for him to learn. There was a game, you know, a while back when Brian Dumoulin actually went out and they had to roll with 5 in that game. And a lot was asked of Riker. He had the most penalty kill minutes of his entire NHL career. And Dave Haxtell said after, there's still some lessons for him to learn. So I think this is a player right now who is certainly more than capable at the NHL level. And it's going to be an interesting balancing act to say, do they put him back in the lineup? If they move Justin Schultz, one of their UFA at the deadline, is he then permanently in the lineup? Do they want him to get more playing time and send him back to the AHL? I think he's honestly the perfect definition of a tweener right now in terms of he can live in both worlds, and I don't think it's going to hurt him as long as he just gets some consistent playing time.
And let's end with one of my favorite tiering exercises, Allison. In terms of, if the question is like to go old school debate team, like be it resolved, right? To tier the Western Conference teams based on your view of how likely they are to emerge in the conference final as the representative of the division.
Ooh.
So I won't even ask you to consider Anaheim, Calgary, frankly. Let's just we'll just eliminate Calgary and San Jose. So of the other teams, the teams that are still alive realistically, how would you? Let's include Calgary. I won't kill Calgary yet. they're on life support though. How would you tier the Pacific Division as it stands today?
Well, you're giving me just five teams, so the tiers are slim pickings. So Calgary's obviously at the bottom. You know what? There you go.
Okay, I could have excluded them.
Yeah, that was an easy exclusion.
This game is so fun. Calgary's a bottom tier, and I think they're going to have further separation just because they cannot go into another deadline and not move their UFAs. I'm sorry. It just can't fly there. Gosh, this is interesting. I fear that Seattle is probably by itself in the tier above Calgary. And then of the remaining, let's see. Oof. I think.
Right? It ain't easy. Especially because if Vancouver can hang on, right? They lock the Oilers and the Golden Knights into a absolute cage match.
Yes. So we've got one tier is Calgary, one tier is Seattle. Let's put, I'm going to do this and all the Vancouver fans are going to scream because it's something nice. And then they're going to freak out because they can't say something nice because then it's all going to fall apart. Let's put the Canucks in the top tier and here's what I'm going to say. Vancouver and Edmonton are the top tier. Vegas and LA are the second tier. Seattle's third and Calgary's the bottom.
Yeah, so I think that's right, especially because of how powerful it is to win the division this year. I think that winning the division is so essential, and because Vancouver's in the driver's seat, I think you're right to give them, you know, the same respect as an Oilers team that might be the best true talent team in the league.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that how you view it? Do you see the Canucks as, you know, you were talking about Seattle buying if they thought they were one of the 4, 5, 6 best teams in the league earlier on in this hit. Would you categorize the Canucks as being a team at that level, or do you think they're kind of, you know, a tier down from that, like 8, 9, 10?
No, I do think they're top tier, and the reason is because, you know, what's the saying, right? You have to have good goaltending, a number one forward, and a number one defender to truly contend. Mm. And that's what I like so much about Vancouver is the balance of where their strengths lie. Now, you know, the goaltending in terms of save percentage has taken a little bit of a hit lately. That might be a little bit of a regression, who's to say. But I do think that Vancouver has built a very, very balanced team. And I really like, you know, if you like a player, you're going to trade for him now. It's just like pulling the goaltender early gives you more chance to win. You trade early, gives that player more chance to come in and get comfortable with the new team, get their life comfortable off the ice and away from the rink, get comfortable on the ice with the systems. So I think Vancouver had the right pieces and they're adding pieces in the right way. I'm intrigued. I'd love to see it.
Hey, Allison, really appreciate you taking the time and enjoy the game tonight.
And we got the name right the whole time. It's a whole new era. Congratulations.
Well, now we know that it's Jamie's fault.
Yeah,
Allison.
We can blame Jamie.
That's right. We'll let him know. Please send him a note for me. Just kidding.
I will.
And, thanks, guys.
And I'll refer to him as Josh when I text him.
There we go.
Yes. Thanks, Josh. We miss you. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Allison, I appreciate it, and have a good one. There is Allison Lukin. Covers the Kraken for Root Sports and 1/3 of the Too Many Men podcast. Got a bunch of texts being like, good job, Drancer. You did it. Called her Allison the whole time.
Nailed it.
Yeah.
By the way, news out of Vegas.
Mark Saravalli.
Mark Stone being reported by Frank Saravalli. He's week to week, and it's a lacerated sprain.
Spleen.
Or sorry, a lacerated spleen.
That sounds rough.
Yeah, you know, you don't need your spleen.
Well, I'd prefer it not lacerated if I have
me
it.
Me too. Don't get me wrong. And you'd prefer to have it than not.
Yeah.
But you know, it's one of those like things you can lose if necessary. In any event, I do want to like get out ahead of the annual LTI thing, right? Like the NHL salary cap is a living entity. Right. And what we consider to be face value cap space, like you can only spend 81.5, is different than actual cap space, right? Like, teams that are not in LTI, every day that they're below the cap, they toll space. So by the time you get to the deadline, you can add more than your allotted, you know, $81.5 million. Like, you have more cap space than that if you're one of those teams fortunate enough to avoid spending the year in LTI, and ideally if you're one of those teams that's able to properly manage the cap, right? So, you know, for example, the Florida Panthers currently would be a team that, you know, you look at their cap hit, and they're just narrowly in LTI right now. No, they're not. They're narrowly in LTI right now, but they haven't been all season, mm-hmm. and they're going to be able to add despite having, you know, 82 million basically. Sorry, 80.3. So they have 1.2 million in actual cap space at the moment, but realistically, they're going to be able to add like 4 or 5 million because they operate below the cap.
Yeah, Cap Friendly has them at 5.7 in deadline cap space right now.
LTI is not the only way to quote-unquote exceed the cap, and in fact, LTI space is less valuable than cap space. The best way to go into the playoffs with a roster that costs like $90 million in face value cap space is to not be an LTI. You know? The LTI device permits teams to replace players when they get hurt. It does what's intended. This stuff isn't cheating. It's well within the rules, and we really have to stop the silly grandstanding about it.
It's
ludicrous.
I have no problem with it. It is, if you're a fan though, it is frustrating that every year it's like, oh man, Vegas figured it out. But realistically, like, you want your team to figure out
ways
to do it.
It's frustrating if another team does it, but if we were covering Vegas, we'd be like, oh wow, the ninjas in Canucks management have figured it out again. You know? Like, it's commendable. And it's within the rules. I really hate the way that we talk about it. It bothers me enormously. I've also got another nit that I want to pick on the other side of the break.
Oh, you have some nits to pick?
I have some nits to pick. Oh. I have a very, very obtuse one.
Okay.
About the Oilers and Canucks in the Pacific.
All right, sounds good. We'll get into that on the other side. Also, we'll hear from Rick Tocchet. Before we go, though, we do have an Abbey Farm report. It's a presentation of David L. Young of Dexter Realty. And just to get you up to date on what's happening with the Abbotsford Canucks, obviously Archdeep Baines called up. And now in the top six for the Canucks, big move. Jet Wu also called up. Rick Dolly, while reporting earlier today, by the way, that Mark Friedman might be a little banged up. So that might be why Jet Wu is called up, but not expected to get into the lineup. In terms of Abbey Canucks results, the past couple games for them, both wins, beating the Calgary Wranglers on Monday on Family Day, and then beat the Ontario Reign in a shootout last night. They got a couple games coming up tomorrow and Saturday against the San Jose Barracuda in San Jose before returning to Abbotsford next week for a back-to-back against the Colorado Eagles. That is your Abbey Farm Report, and it's brought to you by David L. Young of Dexter Realty. Here, there, everywhere, visit homes by davidlyoung.com. It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott, Wolf, Thomas Drantz back on the other side on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, I'm here filling in for Jamie Dodd. Thomas Drantz here, as usual, not in the Kintech studio. Well, he's in the mobile Kintech studio. He's in Seattle. I'm coming to you live from the regular Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? Also,
sorry, are you like shaming me for my absence?
No.
Why are you haughty about
you're
about
in the
me
mobile
not being
studio?
There?
No, it's okay. I think it's gone fine. To be honest, I was a little worried. We don't host together often, you know. So I'm like, well,
no, it's strange, right?
Yeah, it's an adjustment period for sure. But I think we got through it. I'm proud of us.
No, you've killed it, man.
Thank you. You know what?
Especially when you threw shade at me for not being there. That was inspired.
Also, I got more reads to do here. That's the whole reason I'm here is to do these. Jampro, the leaders in commercial cleaning and janitorial. If your workplace demands a clean environment, contact Jampro for a free, no obligation quote. Visit jampro.ca. One more, 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you. Ladner on Bridge Street, Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. We'll hear from Rick talking in this segment, but I wanted to get to your knit.
Yeah, this is the most obtuse knit that I could possibly pick, but it's a thing that we get texted in a lot, or that I see a lot on Twitter, or here in sports bars around the city. And it's a take so transparently wrong, right? Like more transparent than the pants MLB players are wearing lately.
Dude, did you see that? It's getting out of hand today, man.
What?
Getting out
what
of
do
pants
you mean?
Today.
What do you mean?
There's a picture of a I forget what Giants player it is, but there's a lot visible. I'll send it to you. But
please, like, are you like, is there enough visible that he's going to get to walk automatically for four balls?
Close. He's halfway there.
Yeah, he'd need a teammate. Yeah, I mean, those pants are appalling. Okay, so are you a Nintendo Switch guy?
I have a Switch. I can't say I'm a hardcore Switch guy, though.
Do you play Mario Kart?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I want to make an analogy in which the NHL season is like a game of Mario Kart. Okay?
Okay.
So you're on the Rainbow Road that is the 2023-24 NHL season, and you're playing against your buddy. Okay? And your buddy is the Edmonton Oilers, and you are the Vancouver Canucks. Of course you are the Vancouver Canucks, because you're the hero of your own story, and the Canucks are your favorite team if you're listening to this show.
Mm-hmm.
You get off right at the start, and it's like you nail the power boost. You know, like you hit it right on the second light, and you're off to the full power boost.
Yeah.
The Edmonton Oilers spin out. And then buddy who's playing with the Edmonton Oilers, and presumably they picked Toad, because that's whatsoever.
What do you got against Toad?
Toad sucks. Oh. Drives right off the cart, right off the track. Like immediately right off the track. Mm-hmm. So you've only been for 10 seconds, 15, so you got like a 13 second lead. Okay, so that's basically what happened, right? 15 games into the season, the Canucks had 20 points, 11-3-1. Incredible campaign. The Edmonton Oilers were at 3-9-1, 7 points, 18 points back of the Canucks, which in this analogy is the equivalent of you having a 15 second lead, like 16, 17 seconds into the race.
Mm-hmm.
The Oilers fired Croft on that day, 6 points back of the Canucks.
Switch
now,
away
what
from
I hear,
Toad is what you're saying.
Yeah. Now, what I hear from Canucks fans is stuff like, as well as the Oilers have played, they're not gaining on the Canucks, right? And it's partly true. Like, if you look back at the last 43 games these two teams have played, the Oilers have outperformed the Canucks in the standings by 4 points, right? Because both teams are playing incredible hockey. What's crucial to note, though, is that at that point in the season, in terms of their pace, right, the Canucks were at 7-6-7, and the Oilers were at 2-6-9.
Mm-hmm.
And now, like today, if you go to the NHL standings page and sort by point percentage, as you always should, the Canucks are at 690, and the Oilers are at 642, right? And so the way to think about this is when you have to think about it as a rate. So when you start a race and the other guy's 15 seconds back, 17 seconds in, your expectation, you know, maybe they close the gap a bit, but your lead will actually increase as the race goes on because you are better than your opponent, right? Your early advantage, which is significant 15 seconds in, should be even bigger at 30 seconds, should be even bigger at 45 seconds, should be even bigger at 60 seconds,
yeah.
Right? And what's happened instead is the Oilers have kept pace and, in fact, closed ground a bit. So that by the time you get to the new year, right, after 36 games, the Canucks had 49 points. After 34 games, the Oilers had 37 points. That's 12 points. To get fast forward to today, the Oilers are 12 points back but now have 5 games in hand. You can look at it in a facile way and say the Oilers haven't closed, but the real fact of it is that 15 seconds, a 15-second lead 17 seconds into the race implies that you're going to win by a minute and a half, when you're still only 15 seconds ahead in sort of the last, you know, quarter of the race, and you know the other team's going to get all the sick items too. You're going to have to, you're going to get blue shelled. You know you're going to get blue shelled. But when once you get to this point, it's like they're actually still in it with a shot. Now, not a good shot, a one-third shot. You're probably they're going to need a break. They're going to need a bounce.
They need
if
a gold
you just race clean, you're going to win.
Yeah.
But there's still pressure on you. Your early lead hasn't translated into the bigger lead that you would have expected. And as a result, I don't think it's accurate to say they haven't gained. I mean, it's actually inaccurate given that they were 12 points back with two games in hand on January 1st, and are now 12 points back with five games in hand today. But also, in terms of the way we should look at the season, the way we should look at performance as we go, like you need to prorate the gaps earlier in the year. A six-point gap, you know, after 20 games or 15 games is massive. A 16-point gap after 15 games should be just about insurmountable. But by the time you get here to the pointy end of the season, you know, a 12-point gap when another team has five games in hand and one head-to-head matchup against you, it's unlikely that they catch you. They shouldn't be favored, but it's not impossible. They have, in fact, kept themselves in it with a realistic shot, which is closing the gap. And I just wanted to address it because it's one of those things that I don't think people think about the right way. And I was hopeful that my rainbow road analogy might help make sense of it.
I got you. Theoretically, I get it.
I also just wanted to talk about Mario Kart on the radio.
Yeah, here's my issue with it. You say Mario instead of Mario, and I don't love that. But that's okay.
Oh.
You're a Mario guy. I'm a
Mario sayer, yeah.
Yeah. Not a fan, yeah. But that's okay. But what I will say about the Oilers is theoretically, and we talked about this the other day with Vegas as well, where theoretically they control their own destiny in terms of catching up to the Canucks, in terms of they have two games in hand and three more head-to-head matchups to go. So theoretically, those 10 points can be made up in those games. Edmonton is in the end, like, it's unlikely, right? But Edmonton is in the same situation.
We took the shortcut off the start, and now the Oilers are right behind us with a red shell on the last lap. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. Sick N64 reference there.
And what you're hoping for is a banana here, just so that you can like hold it behind you and hope that you can get through.
Exactly right. Well, and that's that. Another texter chimes in to say the only way to stay in front is to use your triple and single bananas and green turtle shells properly. Yeah, just like set
exactly.
up. Game 80 is your opportunity on the final turn to like shoot that perfect, you know, that perfect back shot that like causes them to stumble and maybe costs them home ice advantage against Vegas.
The dream. But yeah, I do think there was like, I will say there was a stretch during that Edmonton winning streak where I was like, man, the Canucks are also playing so well that even though they have made up a bit of ground and it's impressive that Edmonton was doing it, it was, in my mind, even more impressive based on my expectations for the Canucks coming into the season, that they still were able to continue to stay as far ahead as they were. But now Edmonton's still playing really well, and the Canucks not playing super poorly, but hitting a three-game losing streak, haven't been as dominant as we saw earlier in the season. Now it's starting to level out a little bit more, but like you said, the Canucks still have that gap, and theoretically down the stretch here, you just got to play clean. Finish the race clean, and you will finish first in the Pacific Division.
Yeah. If the Canucks go 630, 625 point percentage from here to the rest of the way, which is, you know, worse than they've done to this point, right? They're 681 point – or sorry, they're – that was one of my old dates. They're a 690 point percentage team to this point in the year, right? Like, this team's been playing at a 115-point pace. They only need to do like 103-point pace over their remaining 24 games. They do that, it's going to be just about impossible. Like, it's going to take historic greatness for the Oilers to catch them. That, to me, is the magic number, 625. You get to 110, you should be able to win this division. You should seal it. But short of that, you're leaving the door open.
This text from Aiden in Vancouver. Oh, you just responded to it. Aiden in Vancouver. I agree with everything Drance is saying, but five games in hand with this little time left in the season means the Oilers will have a very compressed schedule with a lot of short turnaround while the Canucks have the opposite. I believe it's, I want to say six or seven back-to-backs for the Oilers through the rest of the season. That is going to be very, very difficult for Edmonton to navigate.
It's tough, without question. The other mitigating factor worth noting is that the Canucks have a much more difficult schedule remaining, right? Like, they have the toughest schedule remaining in the West, the Edmonton Oilers. Like, the according to Dom's model, the Canucks play 63% of their remaining games at home, which is a feather in their cap. They've been extraordinary at home on home ice. But their opponents have a projected point strength of 93 over the balance of the season. The Edmonton Oilers have one of the easiest remaining schedules in the Western Conference. 55% of their games are at home. So it's compressed, but you know they like the Canucks, have played a wild haul of road games in the early part of the year, and their opponents' projected points, 90, right? Like, the Edmonton Oilers have a much softer schedule here over the balance of the campaign. So that's sort of a mitigating factor to be aware of, right? They still have... You know, the Blue Jackets and the Habs and a variety of, you know, the Senators, the Ducks. Like, they have a variety of some patsy teams, the Sharks.
And what comes with that
the Canucks
as well.
Have already dispensed with.
Yeah, and what comes with that as well, when you get them later in the season, those teams have given up even more than we saw early in the season.
Yeah, they'll have, like, college guys in the lineup. Like, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott, Wolf, Thomas Drantz. I did mention we were going to hear from Rick Tocchet. He spoke to media ahead of tonight's game in Seattle today at Morning Skate.
Well, that's JT. What does it say about you guys this season that a three-game losing streak is like a mini crisis?
Yeah, I know. Well, it's the consistency and stuff that we've done all year. A little bump in the road. That's why it's important that, you know, we built a foundation here and an identity. Don't lose it over, you know, two or three losses. Obviously, in the third period, we've lost every game in the third period. So that's something to think about. You know, listen, we've been fortunate all year. Getting some good breaks now. We're not, you know, we're getting a lot of penalties. We're getting some unfortunate bounces, and good teams face the adversity, and you go from there. So we got to make sure we rely on our foundation. We don't go all rogue and be an individual. So I think that's the key for this group.
Well, you must have seen that in Colorado. It seemed like you guys, the system was there.
Yeah, no, we played a good game. I mean, we had a couple of chances. I mean, the goalie was out. We just couldn't put it by him. You know, an unfortunate goal there off the Cole's glove, but for the most part, it was a good game. But, you know, like I said, we got to find a way to win games.
You've talked so much about the character of this group throughout the season. Do you feel that this group is pushing frustration aside and is locked in and ready to keep going?
Well, it's a test, right? We've done a pretty good job so far, but the stakes are higher. The games are going to be tougher, and now your resolve is going to be tested even more. So, you know, don't quit on plays. Don't get frustrated. You know, these are the little things that we have to build a DNA and the scar tissue. You know, this is the sort of stuff that these are, you know, I know we keep saying learning lessons, but you've got to learn from the lessons and make sure that if there's crucial moments that we stay, you know, we deal with that adversity.
How much do you drill down with Archdeep after an NHL debut? One game, I know it was an off day yesterday, but like, how much do the coaches drill down on a guy on his performance the other night?
Yeah, I looked the first two, three shifts and I'm like, hey, this guy's not wide-eyed. You know, this guy, I think he's going to seize the moment. Made a couple of nice plays. But now the next game, it's always the second, third, and fourth game for guys like this. And not him, just for guys that get called up, is the consistency, because it's hard to do. And I don't want to give him too much. Like, we gave him a couple little things, but we don't want to give him too much system stuff. I can't stand when coaches give players so much stuff and the poor guy gets out there and, you know, he doesn't know whether, you know, to wind his watch, you know. So I think it's important that we just give him a little bit at a time. And like I said, I thought he did a real nice job for us.
That said, he looked like he was getting a bit of a promotion skating with JT and Brock.
Yeah, I think he can help JT with his speed. He's not afraid to hit. He's a good forechecker. And I think putting a guy like that with JT, who you know, early in the year with Giuseppe and last year, you know, you get a good forecheck with Millsy, they come up with a lot of pucks, so maybe he can have that DNA for us on that line.
You mentioned PDG. He wasn't on the ice this morning.
Personally, he had to deal with something personal at home.
Okay. Rick, you have such great relationships with these guys, both on and off the ice. I wonder what it's meant to you the last few days to meet some of the mentors and interact with them.
Well, it's great. You know, having breakfast with them, they were in their room. They saw our team meeting, what we go through. We try to limit their son's crap, though. We try to give more positive things. No, it's just, even the fathers that couldn't make it and the fathers that are up in heaven, I think it's you know, it's proud. It's a proud moment for, you know, these father's trips. I, you know, wish my dad was here for this. It's a, you could tell the players, you know, it's exciting when their dad's around, right? Their mentors.
Early in the season, your fourth line had a bit of an offensive profile. Yeah. Hoglander was there, Kuzi when he was around. This group has assembled right now. That's not sort of their identity. What are you seeing? What are you getting? And are you getting enough sort of those heavy stacked shifts from your fourth line?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't. Yeah, we've lost a little bit of that identity. We're still trying to find it. That fourth line where they can go change momentum, whether it's possession time, whether it's with aggressive play, or whether it's being good defensively in your own end. And to go far, you have to have an identity fourth line. And, you know, it's we've lost a little bit. And I know promoting Hagi up has hurt it a little bit because Hagi was really good as, you know, as that role. So we got to, you know, a Lafferty or Amon's got to get better at that role. You know, McKayev right now is on that line. Can they hold on to pucks? Can they play well defensively, but also contribute? So, yeah, that's an evolving thing with this team.
There's Rick Tocchet ahead of tonight's game in Seattle against the Kraken. And if you missed it, by the way, Arshdeep Bains looks like he's going to be playing on a line with JT Miller and Brock Besser tonight. So a bit of a promotion in his second game. And also the power play seen a bit of a potential shakeup with Filip Hronek moved to the top unit at the skate and Elias Lindholm not on the top unit. Did want to get a text in as well. Mike, the urologist from Brockville. Baines and Hoglander in the top six is a vindication for the Abbotsford team and the organizational alignment, allowing for this player development to succeed in ways it's never done before. It's exciting. Baines and Hoglander, both in Abbotsford last year, both in the top six at the moment.
Yeah, you know, look, it's hard to talk about this in some ways because it's not as, like, Rick Tocchet's been the biggest win for this management team, right? I'd say you can literally chart where things turned around from the nadir of January and February last year, where it's like the medical department was in chaos, right? The Boudreau thing looked like a stain on the organization. The team was 24th, 25th, 26th, 27th in the NHL by point percentage. I mean, it was ugly. And Rick Tocchet came in. The team has done nothing but win and play solid hockey since. And he's completely, fundamentally altered what this team is, right? As a metronome sort of governing the day-to-day, he has changed everything around this team. But do not underestimate how highly this organization regards Jeremy Colliton. So Jeremy Colliton, the head coach down with the Abbotsford Canucks, was a head coach in the NHL with the Chicago Blackhawks, in the AHL with Rockford. He spent a lot of years in the SHL. Like, he was a Swedish player toward the end of his pro career, came up coaching in the SHL in Sweden, was very successful over there. Alvin spent a lot of time, like Patrick Alvin spent a lot of time and really prioritized making Colliton the AHL head coach. And it's a crucial role in terms of how this organization views what it wants to accomplish long term, in terms of player development, in terms of having an AHL team that can punch above their weight and make the playoffs, but doesn't run at a Toronto Marlies like budget that produces NHL players. Mm-hmm. Colliton's had some interest. Like, this past summer, he had some interest, some opportunities to interview, some offers. This organization really wants him to stick around. Like, they, you know, again, Tocchet's done such a good job. This is why I say it's hard to talk about it. But it's like, if anything were to ever happen and the Canucks needed a new head coach, like, I don't think the interview process would need to go very far afield. That's how highly thought of Colliton is. And by the way, that matches the Rutherford MO, right? Like, promote your AHL coach. That's always been sort of the answer for him. You know, Mike Sullivan sort of being the most notable example during that Pittsburgh run. So, and look, you're seeing it, right? I mean, the Canucks top six, Hoglander went down last winter and they just left him there. They just left him there. They trusted that Colleton could rebuild his confidence, could use him the right way, could help teach him some of the structural elements that his game was lacking and that could help him get to this point where he's been one of Vancouver's most important spark plug offensive contributors. Baines' story, I mean, you know, we've gone over it at length this week, and it's another one. And honestly, the club's looking to take a similar approach with Vasily Podkolzin. Like, they want Vasily Podkolzin to maybe even spend the full year. Like, I'm not saying they'd be afraid to bring Podkolzin up if they needed a body. Maybe if the fourth line keeps struggling, we could see it sooner than later. But I think the organization's preference is to take their time and put Podkolzin, like, very much on the Hoglander path, right? Spend your time in the AHL, go into the Calder Cup playoffs, be the best player on the ice, if you can be, the way Hoglander was down the stretch for Abbotsford last season, and come up the next year, fresh approach, and know our system, because Colleton's going to run the same stuff that Tocchet does. Colleton's done a really good job, and the organization is higher on him, I think, than we'd even realize, in part because this team's obviously so settled with the right guy at the right time behind the bench at the NHL level.
Yeah, I think I was listening to you and Jamie interview Jeremy Colleton. I believe it was last week, and I was thinking at the time, I was like, man, if not, and to your point, it doesn't feel like anything with Tocchet should happen shortly, but hey, in the future, you never know with coaches, right? Things happen, teams take a turn. Like Mike Sullivan, for example, I would have never thought this year in Pittsburgh would have been a year where people question whether or not he should be the coach, and now those questions are kind of floating around in Pittsburgh. But Jeremy Colleton does feel like a guy who's next up, and I do wonder if the Canucks, because things are going so well with Rick Tocchet, it might be somewhere else is where Colleton gets a shot. But we'll see. For now, everything is just coming up roses for the Canucks when it comes to organizational alignment and the players coming up from Abbotsford and Nils Hoglander and Arshdeep Baines. Appreciate everyone listening today, everyone texting in on the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. Thanks to Thomas Drantz, my co-host in Seattle. We did it. Enjoy the game tonight.
Tortured Mario Kart analogies. Let's go.
Yeah. Mario Kart. Mario Kart.
how dare you.
Thanks to Elon. Thanks to Lena. Thanks to Victor. I've been Josh Elliott-Wolf. This has been Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.